Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne. Sublette County has an ozone problem. Ozone is produced by emissions from the oil and gas fields and contributes to smog, which can cause health problems. Several times in the past few years, ozone levels have exceeded federal limits, and the Environmental Protection Agency has given Wyoming 3 years to fix the problem. The Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality has been working with local residents and industry to come up with a solution. But that's hard to do because nobody understands the exact chemistry of ozone formation. Willow Belden reports that research, funded by the DEQ, may finally be close to providing answers.
It's a sunny afternoon in the Pinedale Anticline gas field. Rolling hills of sagebrush are dotted with drill rigs, compressor stations, and wellheads. Rob Field, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Wyoming, is driving around collecting data. The back of his SUV is crammed full of fancy machines that measure pollutants in the air. One measures ozone, the others measure methane and nitrous oxides, or NOx, which are ingredients in ozone.
We get a measurement every 5 seconds on the Picaro system that measures methane, and we get a measurement every 10 seconds for the NOx measurement and the ozone measurement.
These constant measurements allow Field to create a map of pollution levels in the gas field. At the crest of a hill, we come to a busy gas production area. There's a drill rig, some wellheads, a liquids gathering facility, and a plant that treats fracking wastewater. Field points to his computer screen, which shows methane levels. Until now, the levels have been very low, around 1.8 parts per million.
We're going to watch the methane value, and then we're going to see if we find any plumes along here. So here's one.
Oh, I see. It's already up to...
Yeah,
up to
just jumped up, yeah.
To 3.8. Oh, wow. Now it's up to 48.
Yeah.
As we drive by other production equipment, we encounter other similar plumes or spikes in pollution levels. Field explains that he'll be driving this circuit dozens of times to collect lots of data on pollution, ozone, and weather conditions.
So we will look at how meteorology influences the pollution levels. And if we understand that, then the next step is to relate that to how when ozone forms. Is there a critical level of pollution accumulation that's needed before ozone forms?
It seems like a fairly basic question. How much pollution needs to be present before ozone forms? But so far, nobody has an answer to that. They know the basic pollutants or ingredients that come together to form ozone, but they don't know the exact ratio of those ingredients. It's like knowing that to make bread you need flour, water, salt, and yeast, but not knowing how much of each to use. John Anderson is a Pinedale resident and served on a task force about the ozone problem. He says the unknowns have made it next to impossible to come up with a good solution.
One of the things the guy said very early on in the task force is, let's just get this fixed. Well, how do you get it fixed? You find out the sources of the ozone.
And he says to figure out the sources and the chemistry behind ozone formation, you need atmospheric scientists like Rob Field. The weather is not making Field's job easy, though, because the type of ozone that's been forming in Wyoming only occurs when there's a certain amount of snow.
The problem with this year is the snowpack is practically non-existent compared to previous years. So that makes it difficult because I don't think we're going to see ozone this year.
If ozone doesn't form, it's hard to determine the critical level of pollutants that create ozone. Hard to come up with the equation Field is looking for. But Russ Schnell with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says that does not mean the study will be a failure.
It's very important to know what doesn't make ozone as well as what does make it.
Schnell says he's optimistic that within a year and a half, Field's research, coupled with a massive ozone study in Utah, will come up with answers and provide a blueprint for how ozone is formed. Then it's up to regulators to decide what to do.
The research will tell you how the ozone is being made and what the mixture of the ingredients are. But once you know that, the next question is, can you change the ingredients enough to control the ozone? And that is a question that's open yet. You know, are we going to shut an oil field down because the ozone is too high?
Schnell says there will be tough political and social decisions to make, but he says understanding the science behind ozone is a crucial step toward figuring out how to prevent ozone spikes in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
Last year, a task force of citizens, energy industry reps, and local leaders got together to tackle the ozone problem in Sublette County. They came up with a list of recommendations for the Department of Environmental Quality. Among other things, they called for tougher regulations on industry and more rigorous air quality monitoring. In January, the Department of Environmental Quality met with the task force to discuss how they would respond to the recommendations. They said nothing was off the table, but that some recommendations could take a long time to implement. We spoke with residents and members of the task force to find out what they thought of the DEQ's response.
My name's Isabel Rucker. I live in Pinedale. I'm a silversmith here in town. I thought the response was, for the most part, good. Some of the recommendations are going to concern rulemaking and maybe going through legislation or whatever. And I guess I didn't completely realize that some of them could take, you know, easily a year to even get to a point where they would be implemented. So that can be a little frustrating, especially since we're in the designation of non-attainment.
Elaine Crumpley, Chairwoman of Citizens United for Responsible Energy Development here in Pinedale. My first thoughts were not too impressed. Since then, I've gotten more information from DEQ, and it looks like they have some timelines, although they're still kind of nebulous. And the rulemaking seems to still be not in place, but when you ask them, they seem to have some plans that are a little more encouraging for our situation.
My name is Stephen Smith. I serve as the mayor of Pinedale. Well, the DEQ has been, I think, very responsive to the needs of the community, the concerns of the folks that live here. As far as how they're working with industry, you know, they've allowed industry to put together response plans for high ozone days. I think industry has taken a little bit more of a lead in what's actually happening on the ground than the DEQ has. You know, one thing that was sort of difficult, challenging for us when we first started having ozone issues in Sublette County was, well, how much of it is industry contributing to and how much of it is naturally occurring ozone? One thing that I feel very strongly about is that there should be pre-development monitoring of air quality. That way we have baseline data, and when and if we have ozone or air quality problems in the future, we have some baseline data that says, okay, here's the air quality pre-development, here's the air quality during development and post-development.
My name is Linda Baker, and I am the director of the Upper Green River Alliance here in Pinedale. First and foremost, we should establish a level of ozone beyond which we will not go. I think that right now the DEQ has established ozone contingency plans for operators when the levels of ozone are predicted to be very high. But it seems to me that we should have more strident plans to prevent us from getting to ozone contingency days at all. Why try to just lower those high points when we could be across the board lowering them altogether and we never have to worry about, oh, is the weather going to be conducive tomorrow for high ozone?
Hi, this is Dave Hull, Ozone Task Force member and Pinedale Town Councilman. The response given at the meeting was kind of disappointing. So far, we haven't really seen a great deal of specifics. We know they're working on plans, but we don't know what the specifics of that are going to be. So now we're still kind of talking about what we're going to do instead of doing it.
Those were residents of Pinedale speaking about the DEQ's response to the ozone problem in Sublette County.
University of Wyoming is part of two weather modification studies. The first is the Wyoming Weather Modification Pilot Project, and the second companion project is the Silver Iodide Seeding Cloud Impact Investigation, or ASCII. Both studies are trying to learn more about atmospheric processes and whether people can do anything to eke more moisture out of the skies. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhuroff spoke with Professor Bart Gertz, who heads the ASCII campaign, which is finishing up its second and last year.
The ASCII project, Silver Iodide, Seeding of Clouds Impact Investigation, started its second year in operations this early January. And initially, we did not have good weather. Well, we had nice weather, but not many storms. And I guess the winter's catching up on us now. We have had maybe more than a normal amount of precipitation in the first half of February. And we hope for some more storms before the ASCII project ends in early March.
What have some of the challenges been presented by the warm weather for the work that you're trying to do?
Well, simply that it has been too warm and too dry, and that hurts ASCII. That also hurts the Wyoming Weather Modification Pilot Project, which is a larger project that we piggyback on, and that starts on the 15th of November each year. And in fact, as it turns out, this year they did not have any cases in their first month of operation.
Are you catching up now that the weather is colder? Where do you stand in terms of the amount of cases you wanted and what you have now?
I think we're getting close to the target number. We are hoping to have 10 cases this winter, and right now we're flying our sixth case.
Having less cases, how could that affect the statistical accuracy of the study that you're doing?
Well, every storm is different. Every storm has a different structure, vertical depth, supercooled liquid water content, and that diversity really needs to be sampled in order to get a better feeling for the efficacy of cloud seeding and the conditions under which it works better or does not work very well.
Can you expand a little bit on that? I know your particular project is looking more at processes, what exactly happens during cloud seeding. Will that help you evaluate how effective seeding is, or is there kind of a bigger purpose in looking at processes so closely?
Yeah, we're framing this glaciogenic cloud seeding examination in the context of a better understanding of natural snow generation mechanisms in clouds over mountains. There's much we don't really know about how it comes that these mountain clouds are remarkably efficient, really, in generating snowfall.
When we spoke last year, you said the ASCII scientists working on the project hadn't started evaluating the data that had been collected at that point. I guess, what do you have to report back 1 year later now?
Yeah, well, looking at the cases that we examined during last winter, 2012, over the Sierra Madre in southeastern Wyoming or southern Wyoming, we find that under some conditions the cloud seeding does seem to work. But last year, as this year, there were fewer cases than climatologically expected, and many cases that we did examine turned out to be relatively warm, warmer than a threshold temperature for silver iodide to become an active ice nucleus.
Mm-hmm. So the bigger study that your project is a part of is touted as one of very few to actually evaluate whether cloud seeding works. And it's dealing with potentially small percentages of change and potentially high margin of error, right? So how do you reconcile those two things to get trustworthy results as you're actually starting to do the analysis of your data?
First of all, under the right conditions, in the presence of a lot of supercooled liquid water droplets and the right temperature, it's got to be cold enough, glaciogenic seeding can be very effective, more than 1 or even 10%. It can double, it can tenfold increase the amount of precipitation. But such conditions are relatively rare. And it's really, the purpose of this work really is to better understand these conditions, to understand under what conditions cloud seeding can be effective and commercially viable, and also to understand natural cloud and snow generation processes over mountains.
And so at least from the data that you have so far, I mean, does it seem like a viable thing that could take off in this region that's desperate for water? Or is it too early to say?
I would think that we need a better network of sensors, especially liquid water sensors, and probably also ice concentration sensors, in order to determine conditions suitable for seeding. And if such a network can be established operationally, then I think, yes, this could be a very efficient process to enhance the snowpack.
This is the last year for the ASCII study. What's the next step in this project?
ASCII is yielding a lot of data. We are sampling a broad diversity of storms. Last year, we worked over the Sierra Madre. This year, we're over the Medicine Bow Range or the Snowy Range. The two mountain ranges are different. Snowy Range is a little higher, and lately the weather has been colder also, which is quite good. But we do see ASCII only as a stepping stone to further this this research. We may be looking at other mountain ranges and sample clouds from the ground up using both in situ sensors at the ground, radars, and our research aircraft hopefully will be deployed again with its own remote sensors to better profile the cloud and precipitation.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Irina.
The ASCII campaign ends March 3rd, and GERT's team is still trying to get some cases in before it's officially over.
When we come back, we'll have an interview with Governor Matt Mead. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne. As the Wyoming legislative session winds down, Governor Matt Mead joins us to give his thoughts on the session. We start with the budget, where the governor vetoed three items. One area of concern is the lack of funding lawmakers gave the governor for forest fires. And another is the legislature's insistence that agencies propose more budget cuts. Governor Mead tells me that can wait.
You know, we haven't felt the effects of the first round of cuts yet. So as we move into the next year and we see what cuts are appropriate, we recognize between now and next year, we're probably going to get a lot of calls through the governor's office saying, why aren't you guys supporting such and such as much as you have? So one of the things we're going to do after the session is sort of to put together a layperson's list, which I include myself in the layperson, of you know, where are some of the cuts coming from? Cut back on public health nursing. And people need to be aware of these cuts that we're making and how they affect their communities and the state. And also, you know, as I said, we'll make the cuts necessary, and we've got a track record of doing that. But these are real cuts.
I should probably declare a conflict of interest on this next question because I am a state employee officially, but state employees did not get a raise this time. It was something you wanted to do. They're going to get this one-time 1% bump. How concerned are you that you better do something next time for the state employees? Because it seems like the natives are getting a little restless.
Well, I am concerned about it. I mean, it's you know, certainly on an individual level, I'm concerned about that. But my role is to make sure these agencies are operating at the highest level possible, and you have to have good people to do that. And if you're saying, you know, it's been 4 years or longer since, and you've just remained stagnant. And they, you know, people look around. What's Utah doing? What's Colorado doing? And so, my plan, I thought, for raises was fairly modest. And if you talk to employees, they would say it was provide another term for it. But I wanted to at least provide a recognition that I know this is an issue. And it was a bifurcated plan where we were able to give, quote, some of our best employees a bump, but everybody overall got a bump and a modest bump. And I thought that was a good plan, and I was disappointed that they didn't follow through with it.
The Cindy Hill business certainly was on all the headlines early in the process, and it's not going away. Litigation is sitting out there. Was there ever a point where you said, boy, we really shouldn't be doing this?
No, I think there was during the whole process, though, and in discussions with legislators and certainly a lot of discussions with members of the public, we recognize that you know, this wasn't an easy process, and it was not to be taken lightly. And We spend per school day, I think it's about $7.5 million a day, and we all recognize in the state how important education is. We recognize, you know, the auditor's office, this happened in the auditor's office in the late 80s. And the main concerns I hear are, one is it took away a right to vote or our vote. I think that, one, people need to recognize there's still a superintendent, and within the Department of Education there was a superintendent's office, and I asked for that office to have the same budget and the same people, and for her duties to be moved over. And from her request of a budget, which was nearly a triple of what the superintendent's office was, I don't believe she thought she was going to be without duties. So you vote for a superintendent. The question is, when you voted for the superintendent and we elected the superintendent, we elected her to a constitutional position which provides general supervision of education, and she needs to be able to continue to do that. And I think that's the crux of the challenge in the court now is does she still provide general supervision? The other concern is, you know, there are some that thought she was doing a great job. And for those that thought nothing should change, you know, that is a decision point everyone's going to have to make. Was she doing a great job over there, and should not her duties have changed? And, you know, the legislature felt strongly that on accountability and assessment that we weren't moving in the direction that they felt they had a duty with. And if you look at the Supreme Court's decision in terms of education, it makes pretty clear that the legislature has the role on education, and absent discrimination on race, sex, or color, they have large authority to define where we go in education in the state.
When I talk to people, and there are people that didn't like her, that have had conversations with me, but they have not liked the process, that where you just kind of raced a bill through, you showed up in January one day, you have this bill, and then you ram it through, and here we are. The thought was maybe there should have been a typical hearing process, that sort of thing. What about that?
Well, I think, of course, I don't control the legislative agenda or schedule, but I think I would say from the legislator's perspective, they knew this was certainly a big deal. They didn't want to dominate the entire session, I think, with this. But I think more importantly, because they thought it was so critical, they just wanted to focus like a laser on it and try to address it. And in the same way, they tried to, I think, focus a laser on the whistleblower statute and enhance the whistleblower protections that we had on the books. So, you know, I think that people, as they evaluate this, I think it's a fair debate. Did the legislature move too fast on it? I think it's a fair debate. You know, I think she was doing a great job, or I don't think she was doing a great job. And the people will have their opinions, and they'll make their views known on that. And I think that's a fair debate. Where I think that the state, as I signed the bill, is in a strong position is that constitutionally, the duties of the superintendent are defined by law, meaning the legislature. And I think the legislature felt a duty to redefine her duties, add some, take away some. And as I look at it, sort of the nuts and bolts are left with the department, policy considerations, and other matters are left to the superintendent.
Last 90 seconds or so we have, Governor. I want to ask you about health care. That's the other thing I hear from people. There are some people very frustrated that they think citizens are being hurt by not moving forward on Medicaid expansion and other things that are in the federal law that the state needed to jump on top of. What's your response to them on that?
Well, I think I think it was appropriate not to do the full expansion this time. I mean, there is still a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of rules and regulations. And there's also the promise by the federal government of flexibility to work with individual states. And we need to take advantage of that opportunity and say, you know, if you're promising flexibility, here's what we'd like to see in the state of Wyoming. And let us, that is the Department of Health, the legislature in this office, say, here is the scenario we would like to see for Wyoming. On top of that, it is 2014 that it's going to be fully implemented. And if we are not, as I understand from the Director of Health, if we come in the first quarter of next year with an expansion package, we're not going to lose the match fund that's been promised by the federal government. And I also think with sequestration coming along, with the lack of money the federal government has, I think it's all right to take this year We missed a little bit of an opportunity last year, frankly. I think we should have worked harder on it to trying to figure it out. And I think that's a fair criticism. We could have done more in preparation. But I think it's appropriate this year that we do all we can to prepare.
Do you have the same feeling about the exchange?
Oh, the exchange, I think it's, all things being equal, as I said, I'd rather have a state exchange. But I think there's so many moving parts on that. The part of me says, the federal government, you say you want to run the exchange. You start out, we'll examine it and see how you do and learn from that. And then if we want a state exchange or join another state, we'll have an opportunity to do that. So I think we're okay in the place of the exchange, and I think it was appropriate not to do the expansion this session.
Governor Matt Mead, thank you.
No, thanks, Bob. Great to be with you again.
When we come back, we'll hear about how freshman lawmakers have been adjusting to their new role in Cheyenne. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. For Wyoming lawmakers, the short legislative sessions are full of long days and myriad issues. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhoroff reports that newly elected legislators have a lot to learn quickly, but they're taking their knocks in stride.
You ever see that movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington? In it, a frenetic Jimmy Stewart is newly appointed a senator of some unnamed western state after his predecessor dies. He's clueless as to how, but he wants to introduce and pass a bill for a boys' camp. Thankfully, he has a helpful secretary, in the form of Jean Arthur.
My dear Senator, have you the faintest idea what it takes to get a bill passed?
No, you're going to help me. What do we have to have? What books do we have to have?
Stewart, as Mr. Smith, is both naive and an unknowing pawn in a corrupt plan. But he's also determined.
A senator has a bill in mind, like you, a camp, right?
Right.
Fine. Now, what does he do? He has to sit down first and write it up. The why, when, where, how, and everything else. Now, that takes time.
Well, but this one is so simple.
Oh, I see. This one's simple.
Yeah, and with your help, why...
Oh, I'm helping, yeah. Simple, and I'm helping, so we knock it off in record-breaking time of, let's say, 3-4 days.
Oh, a day.
A day?
Yes, just tonight.
Tonight. I don't want to seem to be complaining, Senator, but in all civilized countries, there's an institution called dinner.
But while the plot is Hollywood, the learning curve on the job isn't totally off base. For example, take Representative Nathan Winters of Thermopolis, one of the freshman legislators in the Wyoming House of Representatives.
Whenever you're going to do something as important as build a new law into Wyoming statute, it has to go through multiple processes before it actually becomes a law. And so I really didn't understand all the steps it takes before a bill becomes law. But now that I'm here and I've witnessed it and I've guided a few through that process myself, I'm thankful for it.
He did it all without Jean Arthur. Another newly elected representative, Eric Barlow of Gillette, is very much with him.
Vertical. Learning curve is vertical, and that could be interpreted as straight up or straight down. Meaning, on some issues, you're just jumping off a cliff?
For him, the issues were one challenge, and the process, one could say the politicking, was yet another.
The process can adjust how bills are considered or not considered, and that is so nuanced by how it's managed in the committee and on the floor, etc., that it's can be quite interesting. Whether you like it or not, it's part of how this process works. For some people, it may be questionable at times, but that was one of the things that I didn't understand coming here.
Wyoming freshman lawmakers say the Capitol provides its own helpful secretaries to take on the new challenges. Well, sort of. All first-time legislators go through a training session. Some say they look for further help from their classmates, other incoming freshmen, or seek out mentors. Senator James Anderson is the only junior senator this term. He looks to different people depending on the issue at hand.
It's by subject matter mostly, and whoever the experts are. it seems like a lot of people have an opinion on a lot of subjects, but there's only a few that are really experts on it that you can really rely on their opinion on the thing.
Anderson says he's surprised how hard it has been to be effective and how stubborn some of his fellow legislators can be.
I've never dealt with the intensity that people have about certain subjects, and it's win or lose. There's no compromise. And I think the guys that are willing to work with the subject and work on it, they can get something done. But a guy with no compromise, he just loses.
Representative Lynn Hutchings from Cheyenne says she lobbied for a couple of years, so the learning curve isn't as steep for her. Fellow legislators have been helpful when she did need assistance, but it's been hard to be under public scrutiny. The backlash, she says, isn't coming from her constituents. Comments she made in a committee meeting about same-sex civil unions sparked attention nationwide, but she says some of the media coverage was inaccurate and unfair, as was what followed.
That has been the thing that has frustrated me the most this whole time. I've tried to work hard, I've tried to study hard, I've tried to be true to my word and do a good job, but it seems like almost for about a month I've been getting vicious emails, phone calls, and letters about things I've never said.
But it's not all strife at the Capitol. Representative Winters, for one, is beaming.
For instance, right now I'm wearing a camel hair sport coat. I didn't realize this is actually an old tradition they've had around here on Wednesday, which is kind of the day to get over the hump. They wear a camel hair sport coat, you know. So a lot of that's just kind of fun.
And anyway, it's just the beginning, says Representative Barlow.
I am 32 days into my term as a legislator. It was an honor to be elected. It is very humbling to actually serve and to begin to understand the complexity of the issues, the various and sincere interests that are on every issue, and understand that you can generally disappoint just about everybody every day based on the issues that are before you.
Senator Anderson says everyone should try it, which probably means he's having a better experience than poor Mr. Smith, who faints before the movie ends. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
The Wyoming State Legislature heard a variety of colorful issues this session, from concealed gun laws to abortion and gay marriage to the controversy surrounding the removal of Cindy Hill's main duties, Superintendent of Education. As the session comes to a close, Wyoming Public Radio's Sarah Hosseini talked with people outside the Albany County Courthouse to see what issues they were following and how they felt their representatives measured up.
My name's Chris Sherwood. The only thing I really heard about is like all the gay marriage stuff. I heard it got passed in one part of it, but not another, which I guess is indicative of politics. But if it doesn't affect you, then I don't see what the big deal is.
My name is Rob Brest. I think they did a poor job. I think that the Marriage Equality Act that they voted down was badly thought out and not very representative of the equality state that we're supposedly living in. And I think that what they did with the Department of Education was kind of a travesty. And I think it's a bunch of the cool kids trying to get their way, whether or not the electorate wants it that way or not.
I'm Jan Ray Satanki. I'm from here in Laramie. I'm just very glad that they addressed the issue with Cindy Hill. I commend them for that.
Phil Roberts. I teach Wyoming history. Some of this craziness that I don't like is, for instance, this law that makes it illegal for a federal officer to enforce federal gun laws, if in fact it ever comes to that. Don't those people recognize that we did have a civil war in this country and it was the North that won?
Dan Frege. I don't think that people should be allowed to have guns on college campuses, because an environment where people between the ages of 18 and 22 are getting drunk on the weekends is not the ideal environment for violent weapons.
Jen Davis. I actually work for the clerk's office, and so we were really interested in the legislation that increases the fees for car titles and marriage licenses, because it would increase our revenues for the county.
Tad Butterfield. Just the lottery bill is the only one I've been paying attention to. Hopefully they pass it. I don't really see the morality issues that they bring up.
My name is Sue DeYoung. I hope the Wyoming legislature gets the lottery through, because I think it's a good source of revenue for our state rather than give it to our other neighbors.
My name's Mark Doyle. Kind of anxious to find out what this rainy day is that we're saving for so much.
you know, my wife's involved with the junior college curriculums and things like that, and it's been quite a while since she's had a raise.
Julie Ferdig. I live in Rock River.
They're talking about raising the gas taxes, and they're talking about whether or not they're going to even remove our post office. I mean, it's bad enough we have to drive 45 minutes to come to the store, but who can afford to do that every day to get our mail?
Tracy Fletcher. We were talking about the fuel tax and that increased, and I guess it kind of brings Wyoming up to other levels. Although everybody's expenses are going up, it makes it tough for everybody.
Mary Allen O'Reilly, you have almost reverse radar for political thinkers, because I am such a caveman when it comes to the entire world of politics. I really don't know anything about any of it.
The Wyoming legislature grabbed headlines early in the session by stripping powers from State Superintendent Cindy Hill. Now, they're focused on ways to improve education. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck has more.
The main bills are two accountability measures that will test how students are doing in the classroom, set goals that individual schools will be asked to meet, and eventually hold administrators and teachers accountable. The effort might sound familiar, because the legislature actually started working on accountability 2 years ago. But for whatever reason, lawmakers say the State Department of Education never met necessary deadlines, which led to the action against Superintendent Hill. As they finally move forward, State Senator Chris Rothfuss says the first step will be to acquire data so that each school in the state will have a standard to shoot for.
We're trying to get data from the schools showing what their strengths and weaknesses are in education. And we've got a number of different measures that we're looking for. We're looking for student growth, student achievement, student equity measures, and we're looking at college and career readiness.
Rothfuss says they will use existing testing methods, such as the ACT, to score high school students. The goal is to get what they need and then take less time testing. Students will also need to meet certain standards in the classroom. Rothfuss says that they will then be able to determine how well students in a school are doing.
And then as we look at those schools, if we identify schools that aren't doing well in certain areas, they're not growing fast enough, or they're not achieving high enough, we want to find ways that we can provide them with the support they need.
Which moves away from where this concept started 2 years ago, where teachers were actually a target of the legislature. They even threatened to remove tenure to get them to toe the line. Senator Michael Von Flatern says that memory still makes teachers suspicious.
They think that, you know, the state is now saying that if you have a flunking student, we're firing you. We're not trying to. We're just trying to take it in generalities, look for the systemic problems, and work from there.
Wyoming Education Association President Kathy Vetter says she can live with the new approach.
I think that we aren't the best we can be, and I think that's what's good about our accountability bills, is they're talking about providing support and helping everyone improve.
The state will develop experts in the State Department of Education and at the local district level to help those who are falling short of goals. Senator Hank Coe stresses that they'll be looking at all aspects of education.
We do look at schools, we do look at districts, we do look at administrators, we look at building principals, and we look at teachers, and make an attempt to try to tie it all together so that we can move forward for the benefit of the kids. They're really the customers in the steer of the kids.
Coe has worked on education reform efforts for a number of years and has watched some of those efforts stall. He says they're going to see this effort through, and he believes it will change things.
I think we are on the cusp of something big.
Senator Rothfuss wanted the legislature to adopt some policies that would allow Wyoming education to go even further. As an example, he wanted to raise the age of when students were allowed to drop out, and wanted to require 4 years of math. But Rothfuss says some districts fought those bills.
Getting to the point where we start really raising the standards, raising the expectations, the dropout age, as the legislation I had, or 4 years of math, those are things where there is that concern that we're getting too down into the weeds and we're infringing upon local control.
Still, he's pleased with what they have accomplished. As he sits outside the House chambers, House Education Chairman Matt Teeter says his goal may be finally reached.
We have the funding in place. We have the expertise of administrators and teachers in place. And the final piece to that, I believe, is this accountability system. And together, we're going to move forward in a way that's going to make Wyoming education top in this country. That's my goal.
Teeter says it's an exciting time for education. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
When we come back, we'll talk with a member of the Baha'i Faith about their upcoming holiday season and what it's like being Baha'i in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne. Most Wyomingites have long since taken down their Christmas trees and wrapped up their winter holidays, but for people who practice the Baha'i faith, the festival of Ayamiha, where families get together and exchange small gifts, is right around the corner.
The Baha'i religion is a relatively young one. Founded in Persia in the mid-1800s, it follows the teachings of two prophets, the Bab and Baha'u'llah. They taught about the oneness of God and of religion, and that God continues to reveal truths to humanity throughout time. Drew Hanick is on the Regional Baha'i Council for the Northern Plains States. From her home in Cody, Hanick tells Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez that the Baha'i faith isn't that different from more common religions. In fact, it includes many elements of them.
We recognize the divinity of Christ and Moses and Abraham, the divinity of Muhammad, as well as those of Krishna and Buddha and other religious teachers of the world. On the one hand, we're very much like Christianity, Judaism, or Muslim in that we say there is only one God. We are a monotheistic religion. On the other hand, we say that religions are on a continuum, that they haven't been segmented like mankind has tried to do, but that God continues to send his teachers, his messengers, throughout the ages as man advances, both materially, emotionally, spiritually, and physically.
So what drew you to the Baha'i faith, and what might surprise people to learn about it?
What drew me to the Baha'i faith was the affirmation that the golden rule is in all religions, that there is one God, and that no one of any religious following is excluded from the broader divine blessings of the Holy Spirit. I, as a child, couldn't understand why some people, if they were good people, would go to hell just because they hadn't heard of Jesus Christ. That didn't resonate with me as being reasonable. So when I heard about the Baha'i faith and said that God has continued to give us the teachings and that we are to follow our path and our spiritual teachings to the best of our ability, that resonated with me.
What are some of the sort of practices or what's the day-to-day life of a Baha'i like?
Well, we have no clergy, so we have to be responsible for our own spiritual development. And in the Baha'i teachings, Baha'u'llah admonished us to read sacred writings morning and evening. We have a prayer we say once a day. The Baha'is fast, which is coming right up, and it looks a bit like a fast of Ramadan, but it's also kind of like Lent in that the purpose is to spiritually renew us. And there are Baha'is in every country in the world, and we're all trying to learn how to work together in unity and appreciate each other's diversity.
So how common are Baha'is in Wyoming? Are you the only one?
Thank goodness I am not the only one. We have about 150 Baha'is in Wyoming at this time. In the early 80s, there were more, but because of the bust of the oil industry, people lost their jobs, so they moved to other communities. The western part of Wyoming has probably the largest concentration of Baha'is. We have no clergy, so our spiritual development really is on our shoulders. But there is community in the Baha'i faith as well. And in communities of two or three, they will gather together once every 19 days for what is called a feast, and we have fellowship together.
I understand that the Baha'i Festival of Ayamiha is coming up. What does that festival represent, and how do you celebrate?
Ayamiha is a time between the last 2 months of the Baha'i calendar where we celebrate our family, do charity, have parties, small gift giving, but it's a time of joy and happiness to prepare us for that last Baha'i month, which is our fast month. We were with friends in Billings over the weekend, and we all had two beautiful dinners together. Some of the children received presents from their grandparents who were in town, and just generally a very joyous time. For my family, we will be having a dinner together and a small gift exchange. And in my family, we also do a treasure hunt of hiding presents and having people go try to find them by you're getting hotter, you're getting colder. But that's our family tradition. Every Baha'i family does things their own way. Some people have, you know, particular foods that they will prepare. And we talked about that, how, you know, for the Jewish Seder, they have specific dishes that they prepare. But for the Baha'i families, it's whatever they have chosen to establish as their own family tradition. We moved to Wyoming in 1982 when my husband accepted a teaching job in Star Valley, and we were the only Baha'i family at the time. So to, you know, make it feel festive for us, we started inviting all our neighbors for open houses. And our neighbors, actually, when we moved to Cody in 2000, they asked us, well, are your renters going to have an Ayamiha party? And eventually some other people who were Baha'is moved to Star Valley and rented our house. And yes, they did have big Ayamiha open houses. And what's very nice about, there are about 50 Baha'is in Star Valley now. And one of the things that they do is they provide a luncheon for all the hospital staff during Ayamiha. And that's kind of a thank you to the hospital staff. And, you know, it goes in with that element of charity and kindness.
Drew Hanick, thank you for talking with me.
You're welcome, and thank you for calling, Rebecca.
Drew Hanick is a Baha'i who lives in Cody. Luling Osofsky is a graduate of UW's graduate program in creative writing. She writes poetry and essays on topics as disparate as Jewish boxers who fought during the Holocaust and being Chinese in mostly white Wyoming. She graduated in 2012. This poem is called The Pines.
The Pines. Some among us are upright, some fallen, and among our bones are brothers and molars of stone, gummed with lichen. There is the daily breaking, a minor violence, smaller boughs snapping off, sockets popped down the thorax totem. Sometimes the upright support the fallen. Sometimes support is just another word for entanglement. Our branches catch and hook, and even a scratchy, old, dried-out trunk is too heavy to hold. So we wait. We wait for wind or time to beat us apart.
That was Luling Osofsky reading her poem, The Pines. That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm under the name Butter Bob. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.